Broadcasting on the Drug Truth Network, this is Cultural Baggage.
It's not only inhumane, it is really fundamentally un-American.
My name is Dean Becker. I don't condone or encourage the use of any drugs, legal or illegal. I report the unvarnished truth about the pharmaceutical, banking, prison, and judicial nightmare that feeds on eternal drug war. Welcome to this edition of Cultural Baggage. This from the New York Times. Quote, "The OxyContin crisis was fanned by sensationalized press coverage and by popular fears that unsuspecting patients getting this painkiller were being turned into dangerous addicts. Instead, the drugs enable them to function." End quote. Even the New York Times is beginning to recognize that this drug war is upside down. Today, we look at medical practice, pain, and the DEA.
I'm Frank Fisher. I'm a general practitioner, and I have an area of expertise in the management of a disease called chronic pain with opioid analgesic medications.
Forces of government in the U.S. arrested just a handful of doctors each year, which severely impacts the whole community and keeps many people from getting access to opioids and other pain medications. Your thoughts on that, sir?
The drug warriors look at physicians who prescribe controlled substances as if they were involved in drug distribution. And in fact, they are. But the intention of the Controlled Substances Act was to make that legal, to create what might be called a safe harbor so that sick people could have their medicine.
In years past, you were one of those doctors who were, in essence, the DEA tried to pull the plug on your career. Tell us about that, sir.
Actually, it was the State Attorney General's office here in California that pulled the plug on my career. I was owning and operating a community health center in farther northern California in Anderson. It's up near Redding. And I had several thousand patients whom I was treating for all sorts of different things, and just a couple hundred chronic pain patients whom I was treating with opioids. But the medication I was prescribing, OxyContin, was expensive, and it was costing the state Medi-Cal program a lot of money. And they came in and accused me of murder.
Accused you of murder? Please clarify that, sir.
The folks down at the Attorney General's office were operating under the assumption that these were lethal, addictive drugs that I was prescribing, and nobody could have taken as much as I prescribed. So looking at the quantities alone, they put together the idea that I must have killed some people in the county and started looking for bodies. What they found was a patient named Rebecca Williams, who was taking a couple of OxyContins twice a day for low back pain, and is working pretty well for her. And she was in a terrible accident. She was a passenger in a small pickup truck. It went around a corner, and her boyfriend was driving, and he fell out, and the truck went on and hit a tree. And this patient's brains were splattered, her neck was snapped, her heart exploded, and she was eviscerated. And they got the coroner to say that she had died of an OxyContin overdose and charged me with her murder.
So, did they take this to trial, sir?
Well, they took it up to the first day of trial, and then they turned and ran. But they accused me of five murders. They threw me in jail and got my bail set at $15 million, and I sat there for 5 months.
It's not every day that they do this across this country, but doctors are demonized as drug sellers. Is that the case, sir?
Absolutely, and there have been a half dozen similar murder cases brought against doctors around the country over the last several years. There was a case in Gary, Indiana, where a guy was prescribing small amounts of Vicodin to patients with chronic pain. He was prescribing maybe 20 Vicodins to last 2 weeks or even a month. And what the police, actually the DEA in Gary, Indiana, they blocked off the street and landed the police helicopter and arrested this guy for murder.
I understand at one point the DEA had posted a new list of guidelines on what was appropriate. And yet one of the people who was indicted and going to trial was going to use those DEA guidelines in his own defense, and they yanked that data. What is that scenario, sir? Is that true?
Well, that's a really scandalous thing that the DEA did. I was involved as an expert consultant in that particular case. That was Dr. William Hurwitz in Virginia. He went to trial last fall in 2004. But what had happened is some of the top academics in the country had gotten together secretly with the DEA over the last several years and put together a set of guidelines. It was called a Frequently Asked Questions document, and it addressed a lot of the concerns that physicians had about prescribing opioids and what law enforcement's intentions were. And in that sense, it was a very valuable document to promote pain management. But apparently, at the Department of Justice, one hand didn't know what the other one was doing. And when the prosecutors saw this document entering Dr. Hurwitz's trial, they freaked out and got the DEA to yank it off their website and disavow it. Now, the latest thing we've heard from Dr. Portnoy, who is our top academic and was deeply involved in putting together these guidelines, is that now the relationship between medicine and law enforcement is adversarial.
That's the way they want it. I mean, without those guidelines, without the ability to know what will be allowed by these authorities, doctors have abandoned the practice of pain treatment, many of them. Is that right?
Well, that's certainly the case. But the line of palaver that we were hearing from law enforcement, including the DEA and state attorneys general, is that they wanted to cooperate and educate with the medical profession. So what the DEA did last fall in yanking that set of guidelines was an abrupt change of course, at least in terms of what they were saying they wanted to do. So at this point, we have a situation where the Controlled Substances Act says it's legal for physicians to prescribe these substances, but it's a perfect storm, because if law enforcement gets the idea that a particular physician is prescribing in a manner that they think is illegal, then they prosecute him as a drug dealer, and these draconian sentencing laws come into play. Hey, Dr. Hurwitz is sitting in federal prison now doing 25 years.
As I understand it, he's a very legitimate, forthright pain doctor. His patients protested vigorously, did they not?
Dr. Hurwitz is just as legitimate as a physician can get. I reviewed his records and interviewed his patients, and he went exactly by the book, the scientific book. He prescribed what people needed in order to have normal lives. And he is totally ethical. He's above suspicion. And his practice was an open book. See, he had been attacked previously by his state medical board at the behest of the DEA, and they had put him back in practice with an agreement that he would keep records on everything he prescribed and turn them over to them and to the DEA. So Dr. Hurwitz reasonably thought that, well, if somebody's out there selling the pills he prescribed, law enforcement ought to take care of that. And in fact, they went out and got more than a dozen of these guys and locked them up in federal prison. And after they testified against Billy, they let them all out. So they let more than a dozen drug dealers go free in order to put Dr. Hurwitz in federal prison for what should be the rest of his life. They blamed him for what his patients did that he couldn't have known. And he was obligated to give them the benefit of the doubt and continue their treatment. And really all the DEA had to do is take these guys off the street and the problem was solved. The fact is that because of this situation, physicians in America are effectively on strike. see, we have what's called the myth of available pain care. Most of us run around thinking, well, if I develop chronic pain, my doctor will take care of it for me. Well, if you think that, you're living in a fool's paradise, because what this intrusion of law enforcement into medical practice has done is it's abrogated the underlying tenets of the physician-patient relationship, and that relationship is essential to having a civil society. It's like the relationship between a lawyer and a client. The government has to stay out of it. There's this idea of privilege. Well, that applies to physician-patient relationships also, except when controlled substances are involved. So what we're having is very fundamental rights violated in the name of the war on drugs. And when you hear the drug warriors talk about it, it's to save the children. But what we actually have is a public health disaster, and it costs economically in the range of $100 billion a year. See, it's a disaster like the AIDS epidemic. It's on that scale. And because of the myth of available treatment, people don't know this is going on.
Well, what this does in at least some instances is force people with pain to reach towards the black market, towards that Afghani and Colombian heroin. And that's outrageous, is it not, sir?
That's true. And a very interesting thing happened with Dr. Hurwitz. They put him in a cell with a guy who had been coming to him as a patient and selling some of his pills. This guy told Dr. Hurwitz that about 80% of the pills he sold went to other people with chronic pain who couldn't get them from their doctors. So, yeah, this is price supports for the black market, and it forces people with a terrible disease to go out and commit crimes just in order to try to stay alive.
What is to come of this situation?
What I foresee is that the pain patients are a sleeping giant politically. Most of them have been so thoroughly abused by the system and by their doctors that they haven't even learned yet that the opioids would actually help them out with their pain, or that they're being denied this treatment. And when they find out, it's like the Gary Trudeau comic strip. After he read Mike Gray's book, Drug Crazy, Gary Trudeau made a comic strip about this and about the pain crisis and how people can't get their medications. And one of the fellows in the strip asked the other, do the baby boomers know about this yet? And the answer was no, but they're going to find out. So what I predict is that these opioid pain medications are going to be out over the counter within 5 years, like Motrin and Naprosyn. The reason I think that is there's such a regulatory snarl around the practice of medicine that I don't think they're ever going to be able to unravel it to where physicians feel safe prescribing these necessary medications. And I'd like to comment that when these medications are taken as prescribed by a physician, they're safe and they're effective and the patients don't get addicted. But we have all kinds of mythology and propaganda surrounding these drugs, and it's all lies. These are the safest, most effective drugs that a physician can prescribe, and they're being withheld in a massive fashion from the people who need them the most. In the meantime, we've got this heroin coming in from other countries, and any dope fiend on the street can seem to get all he wants. So the only thing we're preventing with the war on opioids is the people who need them the most from getting them. It's insane.
If I may ask, how is your practice? Are you getting back on track?
For the last year, I've been doing some expert witnessing, helping to defend other doctors who are facing similar accusations. Having defended myself for the better part of a decade now, with a lot of good help from Patrick Hallinan and Ken Wine in San Francisco, I've learned some of the things that need to go into a defense like this. I was prosecuted 3 times, actually, by the Attorney General. First for murder, then for an alleged $150 theft from the Medi-Cal program. They said I had upcoded and charged more for some visits than I should have. That took another year and a half of my life, and I was acquitted in front of a jury. And then the Attorney General prosecuted me in the medical board venue. That's why I call it triple jeopardy, because always for the same thing. And that's another thing that physicians look at, is this incredible vulnerability to prosecution. See, I also had to fight off four malpractice cases that were provoked when the Attorney General came after me. When you start looking at what can happen, it's no wonder physicians don't want to stick their neck out and take this kind of risk. See, in the current regulatory environment, to treat pain aggressively with controlled substances is suicidal. What can happen to a physician is just incredible, and I don't think most of the practitioners out there know exactly what could happen, but they know it could be real bad. And physicians aren't risk takers.
Well, Dr. Fisher, as I understand it, some of the doctors, as you say, they fly in with a police helicopter, they arrest the receptionist and the nurses and the doctor.
Mm-hmm. And the pharmacist,
yes, sir. And again, they demonize, they publicize it. They try to drag these people's lives and practice into the mud. In my case,
they called the pharmacist's wife the Black Widow, the kingpin of the conspiracy.
Oh, no. But there have been instances where doctors, given this circumstance, loss of practice, loss of property, loss of potential, have actually killed themselves. Is that correct, sir?
Yeah, Dr. Ben Moore in South Carolina hanged himself in his mother's backyard. It's a different kind of OxyContin death. He was, like a lot of patients who can't get treated, he was killed by the DEA. That's an important point here. Pain is a deadly disease. When you stub your toe, you get over it pretty quickly. But if that pain didn't go away, there might not be anything but opioids that would control it and allow you to have a normal life. So opioids are the cornerstone of the management of chronic pain. In most severe cases, there aren't any other good alternatives. With OxyContin, which is a product that sells over $1 billion a year, there are no recorded deaths from patients taking it as prescribed. And when other people get hold of it and abuse it, in 97% of the cases, when death results, there's other stuff on board, usually alcohol. So even in willful abusers, a pure OxyContin death is the rarest sort of circumstance. What that tells you is while these things are dangerous to be abused, apparently the dangers are way overstated. Not that I'm advocating any kind of an abuse, but then they tell us we've got this epidemic of controlled substances abuse, and that's incredibly hypocritical in a situation where we have 100,000 people a year dying from alcohol-related car crashes and 500,000 people dying a year from tobacco abuse. And what we have is this incredible imbalance where the DEA is out protecting willful substance abusers from the consequences of their own actions just by scaring the wits out of the medical profession to try to limit the availability of this stuff. And it doesn't make any sense when you look at it that way. It's the ultimate hypocrisy. What you have is effectively a government agency out of control conducting a holy war and imposing their ideas about what is essentially morality, just like the Taliban.
Let me explain something to you. Drug legalization advocates enjoy emphasizing the deferred success of the drug war, touting regulation as the more sound policy. But a quick look at their stance will expose the undeniable fact that they oppose all regulation as well. The drug problem in America is not isolated to illegal narcotics. Many drugs that have been proven effective pain relievers are legal and passed out by doctors regularly. Their legality aside, these drugs are often no less dangerous or addictive than their illegal counterparts. Anybody remember Rush Limbaugh? Because of the dangerous and addictive nature of these narcotics, the government has implemented a system of regulation, monitoring the amount of narcotics prescribed to patients to ensure that no American will inadvertently become addicted or overdose. So there it is. Legal narcotics for the purpose of pain relief regulated by the federal government. Everybody's happy, right? Wrong. Drug legalization advocates are adamantly opposed to this policy as well. Go figure. The truth is that the drug legalization advocates will not be satisfied until your children can get high whenever they want, on whatever they want. This has been Winston Francis with the official Government Truth.
A July 27th release from a coalition of more than 100 top medical doctors, scientists, and specialists are urging the major media outlets not to create the meth baby myth. In that regard, I contacted their spokesman.
I'm David Lewis. I'm a physician, and I'm a professor of medicine and community health at Brown University.
I've seen so many stories of late about the harms of methamphetamine, but the thought of methamphetamine babies is just not a true statement, is it, sir?
No, it isn't. It's an overreaction to the damage that is actually done by methamphetamine. And the problem is that some of these babies do have trouble, but a lot of the trouble may be due to poor nutrition or lack of prenatal care or lack of care generally in the family, but not to the drug itself. And when there is a drug involved, it's often alcohol and not methamphetamine.
Now, I think it was just last year that a similar group of physicians and medical personnel contacted the New York Times in regards to their stories on crack babies and objected in much the same fashion. Is that true, sir?
Well, it's similar data. As a matter of fact, the amount of damage that's actually done directly to babies from either crack cocaine or methamphetamine is not anywhere near as great as the stories that are written about it. And was a classic example where they predicted millions of retarded babies due to crack cocaine, and it just simply wasn't true. Research will continue to show that it's not necessarily the drug that's doing the damage, but other factors.
Well, certainly the lifestyle of an addict, scrounging for drugs, living low rent, so to speak, to save money for drugs?
Partly the lifestyle, but the lifestyle may not be all due to drugs. I mean, poverty in and of itself plays a major role in addiction. So, you know, the poverty problem and its related problems may have more to do with this than the drugs themselves.
It has been your findings and the findings of these other professionals that there are no babies born addicted to methamphetamine.
No, it's not so much that the methamphetamine during pregnancy has no effect on the babies. It's just that it's overstated. It becomes a press story that becomes over magnified, and it becomes like a synthetic panic. It isn't that methamphetamine has no effects on babies or crack cocaine has no effects on babies. It's just the tremendous exaggeration has resulted in punishment to the mothers, separation of the babies from the mothers in an unjustified way. We have a lot of problems with drugs, but don't jump to the conclusion that everything that's attributed to drugs has to do with the drug. And if we do that, if we make false attribution, we can do a lot of harm.
An international crime lab scandal. A district attorney who plays rope-a-dope with justice. Grand juries comprised of district attorney and judge's friends. And now the jails are overflowing with prisoners sleeping next to overflowing toilets. Welcome to Gulag City, Harris County, Houston, Texas.
I'm Betsy Schwartz, Executive Director of Mental Health Association of Greater Houston. Well, a lot of media attention has focused recently on the overcrowding in the Harris County Jail, and it's important to remember that one large factor that's contributing to the overcrowdedness of the jail is the fact that a very large number of people who have serious mental illnesses end up in jail just because they're not able to get the right kind of community mental health treatment that they so desperately need. When people with serious mental illnesses are not able to get treatment, they end up in jail when that's really the last place that they need to be because they're not going to get the right kind of treatment there. MHMRA, the Mental Health Mental Retardation Authority of Harris County, with the use of Harris County tax dollars, does operate a forensic unit in the jail, which provides mental health services to people that are in jail, but they're only able to serve a fraction of the number of people who actually could benefit from those services.
Many of these people with medical conditions self-medicate with what are called illegal drugs, and that's a large proportion of those who wind up behind bars.
Yes, and the co-occurrence for people with mental illnesses who also are abusing substances is very, very high. National estimates can be as high as 80%. So it is true that there is a large number of people in the jail who have a mental illness who are also abusing substances. And the issue that we're facing in Houston is indicative of a national problem. Certainly every major city in the country faces the same issue because overall the mental health system is so inadequately funded that jails end up being the mental health system by default. In addition to the human suffering, a really important point to keep in mind is that the economic cost of this is a huge burden for all of us as taxpayers. It's a lot more cost-effective to provide somebody with a mental illness the right kind of housing and support services that they need than it is for them to cycle back through the jail time and time again.
This week I bring you a story and a weird turn of events. Dr. George Kushian, who has twice been sued over subdosing claims and settled both cases out of court, was indicted Wednesday on 25 counts of health care fraud, 3 counts of making false statements, and 1 count of conspiracy. It's pretty egregious because you were talking about people's health here, Assistant U.S. Attorney Jeannie Joseph said. Kushian's former assistant, 45-year-old Virgil Opinion, also was named in the indictment, but indicated a willingness to cooperate with prosecutors. According to the indictment, patients received one half of one quarter of the doses they were prescribed, and in some cases were only given saline water. Kushian and Opinion each face a maximum sentence of 10 years in prison for each of the 25 health care fraud counts and 5 years in prison for the conspiracy count and sale of the false statements. So they can't decide one week they're prosecuting paying doctors for giving too much medication, and the next week they're prosecuting people for not giving enough. Although in this case, this doctor actually did deserve prosecution because he was bilking his patients and not doing what he was supposed to. This is Loretta Nall reporting from Alabama for the U.S. Marijuana Party. Until next time, y'all be safe and stay out of jail.
Hi, my name is David Losa, and I'm a member of FACTS, which is Families to Amend California's Three Strikes. I'm on a 3,000-mile bicycle ride, a ride for justice to Washington, D.C. I'm attending the March on Washington occurring on August 13th, journeyforjustice.org. You can find out more information at that website or at the website FACTS, F-A-C-T-S, the number one, .com. And find out a little more about the March on Washington and our organization or your organizations close to where you are so you can get involved in prison reform and change our criminal justice system. Thank you very much.
The solution for the modern era, drug prohibition. 1 million drug warriors fight for the right to eternal drug war. An everlasting call for more death, disease, destruction, and pain. Our guests next week will be Scott Morgan and Steve Silverman of Flex Your Rights Foundation, producers of the Don't Get Busted DVD. Drug War Sam is dying a terrible death. Won't you help in a mercy killing? Please visit drugtruth.net. And as always, because of drug prohibition, I remind you, you don't know what's in that bag. Please be careful. For the Drug Truth Network and our affiliates in the U.S. and Canada, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage, the unvarnished truth. This show is produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston. Tap dancing on the edge of an abyss.